This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Robert Morgan is above all a poet. With vigorous, spare language and an unflinching eye, he has earned the title Unofficial Poet Laureate of Appalachia. His poetry, though, is just part of his story. He reinforced his place as a historian with his biography of Daniel Boone in 2007. He is also a romantic novelist. Oprah's book club devotees broke their hearts on his Appalachian love story, Gap Creek. And he's an astute observer, as keen to understand the nature of the American character as he is to ponder the brutal beauty of the natural world. Robert Morgan was born near Hendersonville, North Carolina, and raised on tall tales and mountain lore. His newest book is Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. It's a collection of biographies that together paint a portrait of how American greed and perseverance won the West. As part of our ongoing series, North Carolina Literary Lights, we're talking and taking a look at Robert Morgan's life and work. Robert Morgan joins me in the studio right now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you back.
Very good to be back.
Your new book, you focus on 10 men who were instrumental in fulfilling that thing once called Manifest Destiny. What inspires you about this topic?
Well, I had published the biography of Daniel Boone in 2007, as you said, and I very much enjoyed telling that story, researching that story, and I wanted to follow through the westward expansion after Daniel Boone, after Kentucky was settled and Missouri. And I remember talking to my publisher about a book somehow as a kind of sequel to Boone, and we thought about Crockett or Houston. I even thought about Johnny Appleseed. I was interested in writing a book on Johnny Appleseed. But I mentioned in the conversation that, of course, the founding father who had the most impact on the westward expansion was Thomas Jefferson. From the time Jefferson was a boy, almost, he was obsessed with the West, learning about it, learning about the Indians, learning about their customs, their languages, the rivers, the mountains, everything there. He had this luminous curiosity. And, of course, with the purchase of Louisiana in 1803 and the Lewis and Clark expedition, he probably did the most about expanding his empire for liberty across the mountains to the West. And I said to my publisher, of course, the person who signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in Mexico City, February 2nd, 1848, was Jefferson's grandson-in-law, Nicholas P. Trist, paying $15 million, the same amount Jefferson had paid for Louisiana, and acquiring everything from Texas to the Pacific. And my publisher said, oh, it was all in the family. It begins with Jefferson and ends with his grandson-in-law. So we decided on that project. I decided to do the book as a series of linked biographies as a way of having these figures sort of resonate off of each other.
Yeah, because it's Jefferson, Trist, and eight more. So it wasn't just one biography. You've got Andrew Jackson, John Chapman, David Crockett, Sam Houston, James K. Polk, Winfield Scott, Kit Carson, and John Quincy Adams that you added to that list.
Right. And after I had written most of the book, I decided I needed to tell the story of the nemesis of this westward expansion, the person who most vigorously opposed annexing Texas and the Mexican War, and that was John Quincy Adams. Adams was not against expansion. In fact, he very much wanted to expand into the Northwest. He was just against expanding the slave states, adding to the Southern power in Congress. He was also an expansionist. And I'm awfully glad I chose to end the book that way, because it's very important when you're talking about something controversial to present something of both sides. And for the same reason, I spent a year studying Mexican history and Mexican historians to give some of their version of these events. I decided that their story, often different from our version of it, was a part of our story.
This whole question of differing version of events quickly takes us to the imagination. And you talked about the American West, something that loomed large in the imaginations of many Americans. And it changed over time. I think it's clear from the biographies of these men how the vision of the West, what we meant by the West, changed as the frontier moved.
Exactly. Thomas Jefferson, late in the 18th century, early 19th century, had in mind a continental nation that was primarily pastoral, agrarian. Anybody who found out anything about New Mexico and the deserts of Arizona and Southern California knew that was unlikely. But also Jefferson had in mind from the very beginning acquiring these great harbors on the Pacific. He believed to be a world power, we had to have harbors there. And he knew about San Diego and Monterey and San Francisco and wanted those as a part of the United States. So his vision of the future was not what became a reality, except in this way. Jefferson, unlike the Federalist, and many of his contemporaries, imagined a huge, diverse country that would include Indians, Hispanic people, Canadian French, and many immigrants from Ireland and Germany and other places, while the Federalists, his opponents, wanted a smaller, English-speaking, basically English country. And this was one of the major bones of contention between them. They vigorously opposed acquiring Louisiana. They didn't want it.
That's interesting. And it also gets to what they, you know, so you have an imagination. You imagine a future that includes this thing called the West. But you can't do it really and also imagine the technology that's going to transform things or the way of financing things, as certainly the Federalist wanted and Jefferson opposed. All of that was going to meddle with the ultimate outcome of what you tried to imagine would be the West.
Well, there were contradictions from the very beginning, even in Jefferson's vision, because he, in some ways, his agrarian vision was of a much smaller country, of people who were essentially farmers, manufacturing for him would be done on a local scale, the way we're talking about local, growing now. Jefferson was interested in that sort of thing. But in fact, in contradiction to that is this vision of this great imperial power that is going to have, commerce and transportation. There'd be canals, there'd be rivers, and though he didn't know it, railroads. So there are contradictions really about all of these figures. I have been asked, who are the heroes and who are the villains? And with the exception of Johnny Appleseed, John Chapson, who is a saint, they're all both. Yep. There's heroism in all of them, and there's some villainy in all of them.
And in part, that's because they can't quite imagine how their vision is going to play out because they don't know about the way railroads are going to change the way financing works and power equations, all of that. You don't picture that when you're, basically raising your own food.
Right. They saw what they imagined was going to be the United States and what they were willing to make great effort, often to fight battles, to go to great lengths to achieve it. But, of course, they could not imagine this nation that perhaps Hamilton had imagined of manufacturing and finance. That was so different from what the Southern agrarians had in mind.
Will you read for us maybe something from the prologue?
Well, the title of the book comes from a play produced in 1831 in New York, Lion of the West, which was a kind of satire about these Western figures, these backwoodsmen. And I'll read the first paragraph of the book. In 1831, the actor-producer James H. Hackett presented in New York a play by James Kirk Paulding called Lion of the West, based loosely on the legends of David Crockett and other frontier figures. The play was an instant and runaway success and was later presented to acclaim in other American cities and in Britain. In Colonel Nimrod Wildfire, Paulding created the type of the backwoods humorist and teller of tall tales. Claiming to be half alligator and half horse, the colonel bragged, "I can jump higher, squat lower, dive deeper, stay under longer, and come out drier," than anyone foolish enough to challenge him. The play thrilled city audiences who felt superior to the frontiersmen, but also dreamed of aggressively expanding the United States into the promised land of the West. The president at that time, who personified the passion for westward expansion was Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. Congressman David Crockett in the audience for the play in Washington, D.C., was called out and saluted by Hackett, and rather than being offended, he seemed to enjoy the burlesque of his public image.
Robert Morgan, who is the author of the national bestseller Boone, out with his latest, Lions of the West, on the state of things today. We're talking about that book and his literary career as well on the state of things as we meet. Robert Morgan. Just ahead, we will ponder the role of poetry in the modern world and find out about those North Carolinians who are also a part of this book, Lions of the West, the role they played and how all of that plays into our imagination today. You're listening to The State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, poet and author Robert Morgan, recently published two books. One is Lions of the West, a nonfiction look at the history of the American West. The other is Terroir, a full-length collection of his poems in more than a decade. It's the first full-length collection in more than 10 years. I want to get back to Lions of the West. North Carolina claims to be the birthplace of three presidents, Andrew Jackson, Andrew Johnson, and James K. Polk. Jackson and Polk both included in Lions of the West. Now, can North Carolina really lay claim to Jackson?
Well, he was born on the border. This is a sensitive issue. Jackson himself always said he was born in South Carolina, and my sense is he probably was born just over the border, but he was very closely connected to North Carolina as a law student. He trained for the law in Salisbury. He actually got his bar certification in Greensboro, and he first was employed, I believe, as a solicitor for the state of North Carolina when it extended all the way over what is now Tennessee. That's how he got out to Nashville. He was working for the government, for the court system of North Carolina. So he's very closely associated with this state. There is no doubt about James K. Polk. He was born near Charlotte. He's a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And though he grew up in Columbia, Tennessee, he's certainly a native Tar Heel. And he is the very center of this book. The longest chapter is about James K. Polk, who is virtually unknown to most Americans, but is considered by many historians one of the six great presidents.
I was surprised to read that, and I read it in your book, so that's where I knew about it, and I know so little about Polk, and as you say, I think many of us know too little about Polk. What is it that made him, why do historians think he is among the most successful?
Well, let's start off by saying he's the only president in American history who did everything he promised to do. When he ran for office in 1844, he said, "I will never run again. If you elect me, I will do four things. I will end the high tariffs that are hurting the farmers. I will establish a stable financial system. I will acquire Oregon, and I will acquire California." And he did all of those things almost miraculously. I was in Italy a few years ago at a study center up on Lake Como, and there were German and Austrian scholars there, including a historian of American history named Gebhard Schweigler. And Schweigler one day said to me, "You Americans know so little about your history. Don't you realize that James K. Polk is your greatest president?"
Yeah. And is that what combination of brilliant politicians, since he had to bring a lot of people together to make that happen, personal integrity and just plain luck made him so successful?
All of the above. He was a workaholic. He virtually worked around the clock. He had no hobbies. He had no interest outside of politics. He, according to Sam Houston, was a victim of the use of water as a beverage. he was not a party person. Luckily, he had a first lady who was a wonderfully charming, beautiful a woman who had actually attended Salem Academy in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But he also had some great luck, not only the support of the great Democrats, the Jacksonians, but people that he disliked personally and worked against, like Winfield Scott, who conquered Mexico and Nicholas P. Trist, who, above all the odds, so improbably, almost miraculously, was able to negotiate the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in a Mexico that was disintegrating, falling apart. And this is one of the greatest coups in American diplomatic history. And before Trist had completed it, he was fired by Polk and ordered to come back. Trist negotiated that great treaty as a private citizen and brought it back to the – and sent it back. He didn't bring it back himself. Perhaps he didn't want to come back and face the music that fast, but it was such a good treaty, it was adopted by Congress.
What was the controversy around it?
Well, James K. Polk was very defensive. He thought Trist had turned against him and joined the Whigs. Because of lack of communication, he couldn't tell exactly what was going on. And Polk himself knew very little about Mexico. And here was Trist, who was fluent in Spanish, and with the help of some British diplomats and a lot of help from the great Winfield Scott, who was not only a great general, he was a great diplomat, advising him. He was able to persuade the Mexicans to make this treaty. He was unrecognized by anybody in this country. He lived in obscurity when he did come back. When the Mexicans ratified the treaty a little bit later, somebody stood up and gave a speech for the honor of this great Trist, who was such a gentleman and who had negotiated the treaty and was so friendly with him. So Polk was the beneficiary of some really good luck and some people who did the right thing as they saw it at the time. But it was a combination of all of those things. And there's a dynamics about history which we cannot explain. There's a certain mystery about it. I mean, at a certain time, things are going to happen. The westward expansion was going to happen. Figures like Jefferson and Jackson and Polk accelerated it. But it would have happened anyway because the dynamics of the westward expansion had to do with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of unnamed people, people we don't know, who went there to settle the frontier, who went to Tennessee, who went to Texas, who went to Oregon, who went to California. And we know the leaders, but basically the leaders and the governments followed these great movements of people.
And you, through the biographies, focus on the leaders, but you try to give us a sense of what was going on with those westbound settlers. How do you tell their stories?
Well, you would have to do it, in great detail, individual groups. It has been done to some extent, but most of them we don't even know anything about. We just know they were there. We can find, a name on a census or something.
And we certainly know that there's a lot to be gained if you're a political leader, if you're a business leader with, sort of eyes on that territory. And there was an effort to bring people out so that if you were speculating on the land out there, the land would be worth more. So that's the kind of top-down approach. But among the people, was westward expansion an important issue? Did they care? Did they feel that that was something that their nation was really bound to do and had there was something in it for them?
It wouldn't have happened if the majority of people hadn't felt that way.
Andrew Jackson, you mentioned him. He's certainly in the book, North Carolina native, and of course associated with this thing called Jacksonian democracy, the first frontier president, but not quite democratic enough as far as David Crockett was concerned.
Well, Andrew Jackson, like most of these people, but at an even greater degree, is just a set of contradictions. And this has been recognized from the first, by the way. This is not, something that recent historians have discovered. His first biographer, James Parton, I think writing in the 1860s, called him an authoritarian, an autocratic Democrat. Here you have this man who spread democratic power to the greatest number of people against the power in the Northeast, the oligarchy, the old guard, that sort of thing, who was in some ways virtually a dictator. I mean, he was so popular, he was charismatic, he was a great landowner, he's a great slave owner, he exploited his power for personal gain in many instances, and yet you cannot deny him his role of breaking the power of the oligarchy in the Northeast and spreading power to the Western states, to the Southern states. He was obsessed with spreading democracy, and people called him an Indian hater, which he was not. He actually liked Indians. He adopted two Indians to raise as his own sons. He became friends with the man he defeated in the Creek War, William Weatherford, who trained racehorses for Andrew Jackson. What he would not do is let the Indians stand in the way of the white settlements and the expansion to the West.
America's Gorbachev, huh? Glasnost is okay, but we're going to stick with the Communist Party. We don't want the whole thing to be overturned.
There are many sides to Jackson. One example of the complexity of Jackson is his two closest protégés, James K. Polk and Sam Houston, were totally different kind of people. I mean, the austere, abstemious, you know, work-obsessed Polk, very close to him and very close to his wife. And Sam Houston, flamboyant, the most colorful, you know, heavy drinking, you know, dressing like an Indian. And they were both extremely close to death. This gives you some idea of the great range of his personality and his great generosity and his brutality when people stood in the way.
I'm talking to Robert Morgan, author of the latest book, his latest book, Lions of the West. You bring out, I think, beautifully the paradox and complexity of these particular individuals who played such an important part in Western settlement and expansion. And yet the myth, the idea of the West is very clear and unambiguous, I think, still, and I'll ask you if it's still in the minds of the American people. How does it get so cleaned up and sort of clarified as a vision? When it is so complex.
Well, it's a vision not only in the minds of Americans, but in a sense of the whole world. As Cormac McCarthy says, no matter where you go on the globe, people know about Westerns, cowboys, these myths of the West. It's bigger than history in some ways, because the West represents the spectacular beauty, these great mountains, these plains, the prairies, the heroism of men against the elements, against the grizzly bears, against the Indians, against the outlaws. It's something we like to believe in, these self-reliant, rugged people, beginning with the mountain men, beginning with Daniel Boone. He's the first Westerner, and rising to heights in Kit Carson and other mountain men and but it's also a place of such sublime beauty. I mean, it's hard to describe those painted deserts of Arizona. I mean, their colors, the mountains of northern New Mexico, the deserts of California, the Joshua Tree, the Great Valley of California, the Cascades. And these people, both the men and women, loved that place. I mean, it was utterly fascinating. They were fascinated with the danger, and those stories belong to us, but also to the world, I believe.
Stories are very important to you growing up. You talk about how powerful stories were in shaping your childhood.
Well, I was very lucky to have a father and other relatives who were great storytellers. I've been asked a number of times how I, a farm boy from the Blue Ridge Mountains, got so interested in history, and I have to say I was more or less born to it. I grew up among storytellers. My dad had only gone to the sixth grade, but he loved to read history. He subscribed to the National Geographic. He loved to tell stories of the Civil War, the Revolution, of Daniel Boone. He said we were related to Daniel Boone because Boone's mother was a Morgan. This turns out to be true. We are distantly related. And to General Daniel Morgan of the Battle of Cowpens, who was a cousin of Daniel Boone's. But growing up on the farm, I found arrowheads, I found pieces of pottery while I was out working in the field, and I always felt that connection to the frontier past and to the Indians and to these figures. So I have really been interested in these subjects all my life.
Basically. Interested in them, writing about them, historical, nonfiction, and also a poet. Is poetry a different rendering of the way you imagine history and nonfiction, or do you go to an entirely different place when you write poetry?
I believe all my writing, both the prose fiction, the poetry, and the prose nonfiction, are basically all cut from the same cloth. That while I was doing research for this book, Lions of the West, I just kept coming across such great ideas for poems. I had to turn aside and work on a poem. This happened a number of times. It's harder to write poetry when you're writing prose fiction. But when you're working on history,
really?
You just keep turning up such great ideas for poems that...
So it's when you're doing nonfiction that your poetic imagination is more stimulated.
As it turns out, well, I think you're using so much of the poetic imagination writing prose fiction that it's kind of all the same thing when you're writing a novel or short stories. But when you're researching history... It's when you keep turning up great ideas for poems.
Will you read a poem from your latest collection, Terroir?
Well, as I was doing my research, I decided I really needed to find out as much as I could about the Creek Indians, the people that Andrew Jackson defeated at Horseshoe Bend in March of 1814. And, of course, the Creeks, the Muscogees, were mound builders. They built mounds along the rivers in Georgia and Alabama. And I just had to write a poem called Mound Builders. The Creeks of Frontier Georgia said they made the mounds along the streams for sanctuaries during floods. When rivers spread across the plain, they climbed atop the fashioned hills until the inundation passed. But later studies would reveal the elevations packed with bones and grave goods, spears and arrowheads, ceramics, gems, totemic signs, and favorite beads. It seems the Creeks deposited their dead, their kin, in ceremonial heaps that took a dozen generations to attain the height desired. They may have sought a refuge from the floods on those acclivities, but what they stood atop and slept atop for safety was the sacred dirt and relics of their clan, the signs and symbols of their hearth, beliefs and arts and holy bundles, too, as all of us rely and must on our traditions and the deep ancestral memories and ways to bear us up and get us through the deadly and uncertain days, sustaining breath and sight and hope on residue and legacy of those beloved who came before and watch us from the glittering stars.
Robert Morgan reading from his latest collection of poetry, Terroir. He has also written a nonfiction historical book, The Lions of the West. And a subtle writer, a keen observer like you, knows that history is a complex combination of stories, the winners and the losers. You've chosen to write these biographies of Europeans who were important in settling the West. Obviously, you have a keen sensitivity to the Native Americans and other stories here. What do we gain? Are we getting the whole story, or what part of the story do we get when we see settlement written from the point of view, these biographies of the Europeans who settled the West?
Well, what you get is partial history, as almost all history is. I quote Walt Whitman in the prologue saying, "The real war will never get in the books." And that is essentially true, that as much as we want to read history and write history and research it, it's always a partial story. That is, the real story would be told from the point of view of thousands of Native Americans, thousands of Hispanic people, thousands of poor people, as well as these famous leaders. The only person who has a chapter who's not famous is Trist, of course, which is odd since Trist accomplished a lot. But what you do is you concede from the first that any version is partial, but that you want to try, insofar as possible, to tell as much of the story as you can through lives. I quote Emerson saying, there is no history, properly no history, only biography, that history is the stories of lives. And I always try to keep in mind that we should consider what Robert Graves calls the Persian version, that is, the version of the losers. And that's one reason I spent so much time not only studying the Native Americans, but Mexican history and the story of the Spanish in the Southwest, because their story is so much a part of it. Can you imagine how the Mexicans felt in 1848? They had lost the war. They believed they had far superior armies to anything the United States had, and here they had lost this war. They'd lost almost every battle. They lost half their territory. And in January of 1848, a foreman on the American River, where Sacramento is now, looks down into a mill race, picks up some bright rocks, and goes back to the bunkhouse and says, "Boys, I think I found a gold mine." And the greatest gold rush in history unfolds on this territory that had been theirs. It had been right under their noses. And they have lost it all.
Robert Morgan is the one who tells those stories in his latest book, Lions of the West. My conversation on the state of things continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, poet and author Robert Morgan. His latest works are Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, and Terroir, a collection of poems. And you said before that all of your poetry is about the Green River Valley in the North Carolina mountains where you grew up. Is that still true?
Most of it is set in that area. I have written historical poems set in other places, and also poems about science and philosophy and other things. But yes, I think a lot of my writing, both in prose and poetry, has to do with that world where I grew up, that square mile of land on Green River bought by my great-great-grandfather in 1838. And I grew up there working in the fields and the garden, climbing trees, building ponds on the branch, running in the pasture, climbing the mountains, picking apples in the orchard there that they had set out. So that's my touchstone, in a sense. That's the place with which I compare, I suppose, all other places.
And you said you grew up, of course, listening to the history of the place and your connection to historical figures, but also a lot of tall tales animates your life, and I think your literature as well. And you've written a poem that is essentially based on one of the tall tales you grew up hearing.
The poem is called Mountain Bride, and it's based on a story my grandpa used to tell. He had thousands of stories about ghosts, panthers, mad dogs, and this was one of his favorites. After I wrote this poem, I remember reading it at UNC Asheville, and somebody in the audience said, "Oh, that story is in John Ely's novel, The Landbreakers." And I thought, really? Because my grandpa didn't, he told it like it really happened. This was a real story. I called up a friend who was a folklorist and asked him about it, and he said, "Oh, yeah, that's an old Appalachian folktale. Probably goes back to Scotland instead of Ireland, since there are no snakes in Ireland."
Anymore.
They say Revis found a flat rock on the ridge just perfect for a natural hearth, and built his cabin with a stick and clay chimney right over it. On their wedding night, he lit the fireplace to dry away the mountain chill of late spring and flung on apple wood to dye the room with molten color, while he and Martha, that was a parish, warmed the sheets between the tick stuffed with leaves and its feather cover. Under that wide hearth, a nest of rattlers, they'll not 100 together, had wintered and were coming awake. The warming rock flushed them out early. It was she who wakened to their singing near the embers and roused him to go look. Before he reached the fire, more than a dozen struck, and he died yelling her to stay on the big four-poster. Her uncle, coming up the hollow with a gift bare ham 2 days later, found her shivering there, marooned above a pool of hungry snakes, and the body beginning to swell. Isn't that a lovely story to tell kids at bedtime? He would send us to bed terrified.
Terrified. But you said, you thought it was... But in some ways, those are true stories, aren't they? Well, I mean, the way they work on our imagination and then shape our futures.
Oh, yeah. Like that in the, at the very time when you feel safest, What do you know under the rock is there? And these stories have been passed down generation after generation. I was lucky, I think, to grow up in the world before television. Other people had television. We did not. And as a result, I grew up with grown-ups sitting around the fireplace talking and telling stories about history, about ghosts, about panthers, about snakes, about what great Grandpappy did in the Civil War, that sort of thing. And for a writer, that's a treasure trove. And, of course, writing is just an extension of the oral tradition.
Well, forgive me for interrupting, but they allow you to circumnavigate, don't they? I mean, that you walk. You said just a few minutes ago, think about what it would be like to be a Mexican and realize that you had just lost the territory that would become mm-hmm. the site of the Great Gold Rush. Well, if you hadn't imagined that before, I mean, your imagination, an imagination that takes in these stories, is what it seems to me allows you to walk around and see that story from so many different sides. And you get a sense that that's what we've lost, that that's what's missing, even in our political debate, the imagination to imagine what's on the other side, how other people are feeling about all this.
Exactly. It's the imagination that allows us to make connections. If this is so, then maybe that is so. And writing of all kinds and storytelling and even writing essays is about making those connections. And that's done with the imagination. If you're here, you know, does that imply that this is true or that this is true? This is true even of, you know, the imagination in science, that a great scientist has to imagine what might be true to make a proposition or a theory that is then going to be tested. So it's always the imagination at work with reason and experiment. Yes.
And absolute data collection. In fact, you wanted to apply your imagination that way. Is it true that when you left home for college, your intention was to be a rocket scientist?
I came to NC State to study applied mathematics and aeronautics, aeronautical engineer, and I loved it, actually. It was very interesting. I loved physics, mechanics, and mathematics. But I wandered into a creative writing course with the novelist Guy Owen, and that was so much fun. I began to think less and less about differential equations and rocket science and more about how to write a living English sentence, something I'm still working on.
What was your first story, the first story you wrote as a college student?
I wrote a story about my great-grandmother who lived into her 90s. And I remember her when I was a little kid. She could talk about the Civil War. I knew somebody who could remember the Civil War. She had been taken out of the mountains of North Carolina because they were so dangerous to Walterboro, South Carolina, where her mother had grown up. And they were safe until Sherman got to Savannah and turned north. And, of course, he devastated Central South Carolina. As a little girl, she saw bodies being brought and heaped on their porch, dogs climbing up on the bodies, licking the blood. And I wrote a little story about her, gave it to Guy Owen. He brought it into class and said, "I wept when I read this story." And no teacher had ever said anything like that to me before. Partly it's just vanity, you know. To have somebody who had written a novel, sold it to Hollywood, say something I had written had moved him that much, that made me feel this was what I had to do. I mean, what else was there to do except to write?
Tell us about this aspiration to write a living English sentence. What is that? What are you aiming for?
To find language, sentences, a sentence that evokes authenticity of experience and emotion, and that brings to the reader, the sense of discovery, of recognition of often what they had forgotten that they know about the world and about people and about the connections between people. There are two great functions of language for the creative writer. One is the power of naming, to find the perfect word, the perfect phrase that evokes something. Indians were great poets. I mean, they named things, you know, with the reality. I mean, something that really was significant. The other great power of language is the power of narration. And the very basis of language is sentences, subject, verb, object, which is a story. But for some reason, it makes us feel better to connect with other lives and people's experience, particularly people who are struggling. Because we're struggling, but to watch other people struggling, often with much greater obstacles and greater problems, makes us feel better, and it makes us feel connected to the community of mankind. And I think fiction and history writing, storytelling, is so important because of that, that we feel isolated in our lives. We're in our cars, we're at our computers, and you read a story, and that story reaches across boundaries to other people, other lives, other struggles, across gender, across race, across ethnicity, across geography, and even time and language through translation, so that reading War and Peace, and we have the sense of sharing the experience of the Napoleonic Wars and of romances and ballrooms in St. Petersburg and Moscow, and that makes us feel connected to the human race. I mean, that's very important to know those stories.
Your use of the phrase, the perfect word, though, and all that you've been saying suggests that you believe there is something essential in human nature and in human beings, that we all have a subjective experiences, very different experiences, and are unique in some ways, but that there is something essentially human that the right word or phrase can access in pretty nearly all of us. Is that true?
The true poetry is already in the language from these thousands of years of people speaking it and remembering it. And it's the work of a writer to get to what I call the bedrock of language. That is, to the phrase, the word, the sentence that just seems absolutely accurate.
But if it's going to work for all of us, it means that there's something essential that there's some kind of tuning fork in each of us tuned to the same note, however different our experiences might be from that point.
That is one of the wonderful paradoxes about language, that we're living in a world where, let's say, the deconstructionists try to prove to us that language never does what we want it to do, that it's basically impossible to communicate with language. Of course, they're using language to persuade us of that. But the great power on the pulse and in memory of Hamlet, let's say, or the Iliad, proves that there's something in most people that can respond to the same stories, the same rhythms, the same use of language. And it's a kind of miracle that I can write something and somebody sends me an email saying I'm dying of cancer and I want you to know that reading your book, you know, made me feel better.
Will you read another poem for us? Maybe one from Terroir, your latest collection?
Yes, this is another poem I wrote while doing research for Lions of the West. I think it was in Bernard DeVoto's book called Across the Wide Missouri. I came on this picture and a description of a circle of buffalo skulls out on the prairie. I called a medicine circle, and I wrote a poem with that title. White hunters on the plains found rings of skulls of buffalo and elk, and sometimes skulls of wolves and even human skulls, arranged in careful circles on the grass, in Golgothas, on level ground. They understood the glaring hoops were ceremonial sacred sites, but ask what kind of medicine was practiced in these halo walls. Were circles pits for holy chants, or special invocations to attract the mighty bison herds, or yards for dances or for prayer? Or were they merely signs to stars and windy sky of presence and ambition to make sense and form of random residue of death, or staged for comfort tokens of mortality? White hunters at the center of a ring felt power and promise of their mission to the wilderness and blessing for their quest, but couldn't guess that in a few decades they'd work a spell themselves to fill horizon's ring with death's head bones that gleamed across the emptiness, inspiring land with burning wind and bitter dust and white of different medicine in orbit round the blinding sun.
Robert Morgan reading a poem from his latest collection of poetry called Terroir. He's also written a book of nonfiction, Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. You have covered a great deal of ground already in your career. What's next for you?
I am just finishing a sequel to the novel Gap Creek called The Road from Gap Creek. I wanted to go back to Julie and Hank and their family and take them forward into the 20th century and up into the Depression years and even into World War II.
Well, that's going to please an awful lot of people to hear that that's coming out. Do you find yourself wanting to sort of immersed in one and wanting to write the other, immersed in nonfiction and saying, oh, I wish I was writing a novel right now?
No, whatever I'm working on seems like the most important thing in the world until I finish it. I love to go from one to the other. It's refreshing to go from writing nonfiction to writing fiction and to writing poems. I often write poems while I'm working on something else, especially on history. But I think these different genres reinforce each other. And there's a kind of myth in our culture that you can only do one. You can only be a poet. You can only be a fiction writer. And notice that it's much more common among Southern writers to write in several genres, that, you know, the James Agees, the Robert Penn Warrens, the Alice Walkers tend to write in more than one genre, short stories, novels, nonfiction.
Why is that? Poetry. What is it about Southern writers, do you think?
I do not know. I've thought about that. What is it in our culture that makes it seem flexible, that you don't need to stick with one genre, you don't need to be so specialized? I really don't know, but I know it's a fact that there, you know, people like Fred Chappell, my teacher, I mean, he's a poet, he's a fiction writer, he's a critic. It's much more common among Southern writers.
We will let the mystery live in your work, and we thank you so much for it, and thank you for being on the program, Robert Morgan. Thanks so much.
Very good to be here.
Robert Morgan, his newest books are Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, and Terroir, a collection of poems. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you want to listen to an archived edition or send us an email, you can go to stateofthings.org. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.